This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
This is In Conversation. I'm Robin Williams, and staying with the movies for a moment, do you remember the film The Day After Tomorrow? Perhaps you saw it a couple of years ago. The weather changes, civilization freezes over, and everyone who once denied global warming says how sorry they are. Those who aren't dead and buried, that is. Well, the scientific advisor on the film was Dr. Michael Molitor, who also happens to be Chief Executive Officer of Climate Wedge Limited, based in London. But he lives in Sydney. So tell me, how did you come to be involved in The Day After?
I was, at the time I got a call from the screenwriter, Jeffrey Nachmanoff. I was actually running PricewaterhouseCoopers Climate Change Services business in London. And he called me and said, you don't know me, but my roommate at Harvard took your course. You're responding to climate change course. I'm a screenwriter in Los Angeles. I've been hired to write a screenplay on a film that involves climate change, global warming. And I called my college roommate and said, who is that wacky guy that you took that course from? Because he used to talk quite a lot about it. So he remembered you and put me in touch with you. So that's how it all started. I got a call out of the blue.
Were you based in Harvard teaching, or did you happen to visit?
I was at Harvard for a three-year postdoctoral fellowship.
In what field? Science or money or what?
I had a sort of unusual position. I was part of this emerging global environment program, so my task was to try to think about how to combine all the different relevant parts of Harvard University into a unified global environmental research and teaching program.
Okay, so you got the call, and by this amazing coincidence, because your friend happened to mention your name, and you were called in to advise on the scientific aspects, or yes, the political ones as well.
Yes, they said, we've decided that the film should be based, at least in part, in robust science, and we'd like you to help us manage the scientific process, not just give advice, but also help them interact with leading scientists in the field, environmental organizations, scientific organizations in that process. And then they understood that I was also involved in the Kyoto negotiations, and there was a scene in the film involving the negotiations in Delhi, and I had been at those negotiations. So I also provide some advice about what those meetings are like and what actually takes place there.
Well, just an unbelievably rapid summary of the plot, where there is climate change, and the significant part about it is it's incredibly fast. And the paradox with global warming is it can, in fact, set off an ice age. And one of the explanations is that there is a sort of change in the ocean currents, and therefore you don't have, like, the Gulf Stream, which is warming northern Europe and various other effects like that. And therefore, suddenly, there's this snap freeze. And various people who are, for instance, in a library in New York are isolated there and manage just to survive. But the point about the rapidity of the effect was something that I took at first, you know, when I read the reviews, as a bit of a liberty. It kind of worked in the film very nicely, but how far away were they in the movie from your advice on how quickly such an effect could be caused?
Well, the evidence seems to suggest that those kinds of changes would take place over years to decades, not days to weeks, which the film took liberties with. So that's quite a divergence. But in fairness to the film, to the writer, to the director, and to the producer, when they hired me, they said, listen, you know, we are going to take certain liberties. This is, in fact, a Hollywood film. We're not making a BBC or ABC documentary here.
And I thought it was quite effective, as I said, because it symbolized what was going to happen. And just like many scientific effects in television movies, for example, like not least forensic ones, which take, you know, DNA analysis takes hours in the film, which might take months actually in real life. So you had this result, and the effect was global in the movie The Day After Tomorrow. But what do you think the impact was of that film in general, first of all with the public?
Well, there were several. When we were out promoting the film, I sat on several panels around the world with local scientists, local climate scientists. And the uniform view before the film was some concern on the part of scientists that the film shows such dramatic, exaggerated effects that people would say, well, this is so far beyond my control, I really don't have to worry about it. You know, it's like an asteroid hitting the Earth. And that was sort of a uniform view. The result of that was a series of surveys that were done, I think, in about 9 countries, one of which was done by the Tyndall Center in the UK. And the results of those surveys were published in Nature. And they overwhelmingly showed a huge uptake in terms of people's interests and awareness of the issue. So the, at least, if you will, the result of the survey seemed to suggest the film did quite a lot in raising awareness about this problem.
And of course, the great deniers all through the film, the politicians, that's what's going to come to the political reaction, eventually did the huge mea culpa at the end, deeply satisfying. I can't imagine them for a second doing that in real life. Can you?
Yeah, it would be hard to imagine. I mean, even if we saw a large-scale destabilization event in the climate system, I couldn't imagine a political leader saying, I failed to take action, and if I had taken action, things might have been different.
Quite extraordinary. Now, going back to the way you grew up, Southern California, you come from a French family, but you grew up in Southern California, not far from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, where, of course, about 50 years ago, they first spotted this huge change in carbon dioxide. What happened?
Well, the prevailing view in the 50s was that it really didn't matter how much CO2, carbon dioxide, humans produced. The oceans had this enormous capacity to draw down, take in CO2. And there was so much more CO2 in the oceans than in the atmosphere, people felt it really wouldn't matter. Well, Roger Revelle, my mentor in the 50s, said that just didn't sit right with him. So he and his colleague Hans Suess went to sea and actually made measurements at partial pressure of CO2 in seawater. And it was clear from the evidence that the oceans would take up some of this human CO2, but not all of it. And that would mean that it would be accumulating in the atmosphere. So there was general, you can imagine, challenges with that view. And so Revelle decided to set the record straight. He hired a young guy from Caltech, a guy named Charles David Keeling, and said, your job is to measure atmospheric CO2. Because if I'm right, if Hans Suess and I are right, that atmospheric CO2 has to be accumulating and the number has to go up every year. So you might remember the famous Keeling curve starts in about 1958 with a measurement of 315 parts per million, and we're now, of course, above 380. So, in fact, Revelle and Suess were correct.
And when did you meet them to talk about this?
I met Roger Revelle in 1981, in June of 1981. I arrived at Scripps to do a fellowship in seafloor geochemistry. I hadn't heard about climate change. I mean, I'd heard about it in sort of popular press, but I hadn't studied as a student. And I was there to figure out how to mine the ocean floor for metals. And Revelle grabbed me the first day I was at Scripps and said, don't waste your time on this. Climate change is going to be the biggest problem in your lifetime. You have the basic skills. You should worry about how much CO2 is going in and out of the oceans. So that's what I spent my year doing.
The interesting thing about Scripps, apart from blowing the whistle on CO2 50 years ago now, or 48 if you like, is that they've also had studies of the way that sound is conducted in the deep ocean to see whether the ocean is warming or not, the study of plankton to see whether there's a change as a result of warming. They've looked at the chemistry of the atmosphere, and it must be on about 10 or 12 different levels they've got evidence accumulated. It's not simply the CO2. And one wonders really, with that accumulated evidence, why there is, in some circles, a denying of what the scientists are saying, because there are so many. There are 1,100 scientists at Scripps, 1,100 of them. I've never met one who's a skeptic about climate change and its effect. So how do you interpret the skepticism at large?
Well, I'm going to venture out of science here. I mean, my work outside of science suggests that carbon is ubiquitous. So if you're a politician or you're a businessman, and all of a sudden someone's saying, you've been using the atmosphere for free as a sewer for these waste gases, and now we have to assign a cost because there's a potential of destabilizing the climate system, you know, you're looking at massive change. I mean, carbon is an integral part of our energy system globally, right? People resist change. I mean, I think that's a fairly common understood phenomenon. I think immediate hesitancy, the immediate reaction is to say, wait a minute, you couldn't possibly have the science correct here, because the kinds of changes we would need to undertake to manage this risk are absolutely enormous. So my sense is it's just this absolute reaction towards the idea that carbon is ubiquitous and change would mean changing everything, which in fact it does.
And of course, there have been so many false alarms. I don't know whether Y2K bugs, you know, turn of the century, everyone was worried that the computers would go bung because they misread the date or something, and nothing happened, and you find that there's a scare and the world adjusts. This is different, is it?
Yes. I mean, this is substantially different. The evidence, the historical record's pretty clear. You know, we've seen a change in atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, unlike anything we've seen certainly in the last 700,000 years and probably substantially longer than that. So the atmosphere of this planet has seen a jolt, both in terms of the change in concentration and the time. probably more important than the absolute change in concentrations is how quickly it's occurred. Yeah, that's a real concern. And I think the evidence is completely overwhelming.
Overwhelming, and the science is one thing, but now you're looking at it. You mentioned Price Waterhouse. You're involved with financial aspects of life. How would finance come into it to make a difference?
Well, if you look at the scale of this problem, if we're going to attempt to stabilize concentrations at a safe level, and let's assume that we agree that 500 parts per million is a safe level, to achieve that number by the year 2050 would mean we need to avoid something like 500 billion tons, metric tons of carbon dioxide. That's a staggering number. If you assume a cost of an average cost of $20 a ton US for those reductions, you have a $10 trillion problem. You can argue that it's $1 trillion, or you can argue it's $100 trillion, but the order of magnitude is $1 trillion. So that means we need to activate. We need to find $1 trillion that the market's competing for, whether it's for sports or entertainment or all the other things that capital competes for.
I happen to know that $1 trillion is the amount that the world will soon spend on diet measures.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's lots of other embarrassing metrics like that. So I realize that this is now a capital markets problem because we need massive reductions and we need them soon. We can't wait. So we need to find a compelling way of leveraging the most powerful force on this planet, capital markets. We need to find a way of allowing investors to get sufficiently attractive returns so that we can pull that $1 trillion out of the market and apply it to rapidly accelerating low carbon, the penetration of low carbon technologies.
So how would it work?
Obviously, it would work a lot faster if we had a global regime that governments agreed to where there was a market price enforced through regulation. But of course, governments aren't doing that. We have an emissions trading scheme in Europe, but the rest of the world seems to be floundering, and that's not happening on a scale that's meaningful to this problem. I think $5 billion of carbon were traded last year, so the scale isn't large enough. What we need is the markets have to recognize that carbon performance by companies equals financial performance, right? I mean, the CEOs, the men and women who run the world's largest companies, they're concerned about share price. Once they believe that their share price is going to be impacted by their carbon performance, they will allocate significant resources to solving this problem. So capital markets are now realize that there is a link between carbon performance and financial performance. And I'll give you one example. Our organization in London belongs to something called the Carbon Disclosure Project. This is 215 financial institutions who between them manage $31 trillion. So never in the history of capital markets have a group of financial institutions pooled resources and attempted to put pressure on companies for any single cause. These organizations are calling up every single company in the world and saying, listen, we own a lot of your stock. In fact, we own most of your stock. We think there's a link between what you're doing about your greenhouse gas emissions and your financial performance. If you do not improve your carbon performance, your greenhouse performance, it's going to affect your financial performance and it's going to affect your share price.
And would they enforce that warning?
Well, that's a great question. How do you enforce the warning? The way you enforce the warning is you see a large pension fund in California announcing in the next 90 days that it's offloaded all of its shares in a large company because they failed to improve their carbon performance and they felt that company is underperforming. Remember, these large institutional investors, huge pension funds, super funds here, and superannuation funds here in Australia who have billions of dollars under management, they have large share portfolios. And every day they're attempting to assess which companies are performing, which are underperforming. And they sell shares in companies that underperform all the time. What the capital markets are saying now is, if your carbon performance is bad, you're underperforming and you're going to be sold like anybody else.
Of course, we had the Group of Six here last month in Australia, including Westpac and Swiss Re and four others, who did something similar standing out. Were you aware of that?
Yes, I was.
Are you part of that?
No, I wasn't directly part of that, although I did attend the first meeting, organizational meeting, I think a little over a year ago when IAG and others were thinking about how to organize this. Yes, I mean, that's a great market signal. When CEOs of six large firms, these six large firms step out and say, basically repeating just what I said, that we see a link between our carbon performance and our financial performance, and we need to do something about that to look after our shareholder interests.
So what do you think is going to happen next? Given that, according to the scientific warnings, they're not quite as diabolical as the day after tomorrow, maybe the day after next decade, but maybe we've got 10 years, if the evidence is more or less online, to get our act together. so far, the people who have given supporting counsel like Tony Blair have been accused of not taking appropriate action despite their words. And that leaves, of course, the other people from maybe Australia, maybe the United States, who are even more, as Paul Keating used to say, recalcitrant. What's really going to shake them up?
Well, I think today the biggest pressure on companies to change their behavior is coming from the financial community. I think we're starting to see a big shift. I think we can expect to see a big change in the presidential elections in the United States in 2008. I suspect that climate change is going to be a major topic for the first time in the presidential elections. I mean, both sort of Hillary Clinton and John McCain have traveled to the Arctic together to look at changes. They've made speeches, public speeches about this. So it's pretty clear that, assuming that they are going to be serious candidates, this is going to be an important part of the debate. I think the political landscape will change. I think many of the companies and industry associations that went to their governments and said, we would prefer that you not take action on climate change. We don't think the science is robust. And all you're going to do is erode the local economy as a result. I think many of those companies have now changed their views. And their reinsurance companies and the companies in the financial value chain support them have gone to them and said, listen, this is real. So I think we're slowly seeing a change. The big question, of course, is it occurring on a timescale meaningful to the problem?
Well, of course, in The Day After Tomorrow, in the film, it was line ball. Do you think we'll make it? In your private moments?
Well, I'm staking my life on it. I live in Australia, the country that I think is probably potentially most impacted from climate change, both by geophysical changes and also by the sort of economic changes. So I'm taking a big bet. I love living here. I love the lifestyle. But if we don't get it right, Australia is going to be in a very, very difficult position. So I guess I've got a big personal bet.
Explain that, because some people say we're in fact protected down here.
Well, if you look at the models, you're 20 million people living on a semi-arid continent, you know, sort of living on the fringes. I mean, water, of course, is all Australians know is a huge limiting factor. You don't need to see a big change in the climate regime in this part of the world to see a change in the availability of fresh water, you know, Murray-Darling and all the other salinity issues that you have. I mean, the probability that you're going to exacerbate those problems that you already have, is quite high. So that's an example of a geophysical punch. Hurricane Larry is another example, you know, increased events, these extreme weather events. On the economic side, you know, you're a country that makes most of its money exporting carbon-intensive or greenhouse-intensive products, like energy coal. You know, if there's a price assigned to that, and that changes. So it's a double whammy. It's a geophysical punch and an economic punch together.
So Australia's position in all sorts of ways is very important in this scheme.
Absolutely. I mean, the absence of what appears to be a complete absence of federal policy in Australia on climate change is shocking, because the downside potential for Australia is enormous, but the upside potential is enormous as well. I mean, if oil stays above $50 a barrel or climbs to $100 a barrel, and you can capture CO2 emissions from coal, and Australia is the largest net exporter of coal and uranium, and you think uranium is going to come back into vogue because of the role of nuclear power, then all of a sudden the upside situation for Australia is dramatic. I mean, Australia becomes an enormous net exporter of energy, and the value of those energy exports will go way up.
So there's the market opportunity. Dr. Michael Molitor is Chief Executive Officer of Climate Wedge Limited, and he was scientific advisor on the film The Day After Tomorrow. Next week, another American who lives in Sydney, Devon Holmes-Acourt, plus those helping her with a newly launched website on how to be a scientifically minded parent. Catalyst coming up on ABC Television in a couple of minutes, The Tipping Point on Climate, and Paul Willis, this is unmissable, shaves his legs. Catalyst at 8. Here on Radio National, it's nearly 8 o'clock.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.